Welcome to the latest episode of Warships Pod. And today I have two very distinguished guests, Dr. Gary Blackburn, an honorary fellow of the Centre for Security Studies at the University of Hull, which seeks to enhance understanding of the nature of war and strategy, while also providing guidance on best practice in war and strategy to professional stakeholders. Gary has taught security studies and military history at the universities of Leeds and Hull, respectively, and has written for Defence Studies and The Critic, and for the latter about aspects of the UK's 2021 Integrated Review of Defence and Security. Our other esteemed guest is Mark Grove, a senior lecturer in strategic studies specialising in maritime strategy, warfare and security at the University of Lincoln's Maritime Study Centre at the Royal Naval College in Dartmouth, where he has taught for 24 years, originally working directly for the Ministry of Defence. Mark has written on amphibious warfare, the naval history of the Second World War and the Falklands, though over the last decade or more has spent most of his research time examining the threats posed by the Russian and Chinese navies, on which he has provided briefings for several UK and NATO headquarters and government departments. So, welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I wonder if we could start and cut straight to the chase and look at the top issue of the day, which would have to be Russia's war on Ukraine. And in particular, I wonder if I could ask you to give your perspectives on who, if anyone, is winning the contest at sea. So, Mark, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I think there are two ways of looking at this. From an information operations or a propaganda point of view, it's clearly the Ukraine, with the well-publicized sinkings of the Moskva, of the LST, of the two Raptors more recently. But in truth, from a strategic point of view, despite its well-publicized losses, it's Russia. It's still able to enforce its blockade, though admittedly more distantly is being pushed off by the missile threat. So Ukraine can't use its ports, and this in turn has a wider effect, an increasingly serious impact on global food supplies. Russia is also still able to operate against targets along the Ukrainian coastline, along the Sea of Azov, including the reported use of naval gunfire support against Mariupol. And of course, it's still able to use the sea as a convenient launching pad for its caliber land attack cruise missiles. Of course, the one thing that many people are focused upon is the amphibious side. Now, it's true that we haven't seen an actual operation against the key port city of Odessa. The demonstrations were held there earlier in the campaign in order to fix Ukrainian defenders there. And with the obvious threat posed by the Neptune missiles, and indeed the use of anti-tank missiles and the heavy losses to naval infantry used ashore, particularly at Mariupol, we're very unlikely to see this happen. Many have misunderstood Russian amphibious capabilities, their doctrine, their intentions. Despite reinforcements from other fleets, Russian amphibious forces in the Black Sea were relatively modest. And it should be remembered that their traditional doctrine involves a landing just along the coast from where ground forces would be approaching from overland, from further along the shoreline. They also have traditionally relied very heavily on direct beaching of LST's landing ship tank. And of course, the missile and the mine threat and a combination of the both makes this increasingly risky. I think what the conflict has demonstrated, though, are some key Russian weaknesses. The lack of sufficient sea control, more accurately, battle space dominance, to facilitate the sort of operations that Russia clearly wanted to undertake in the first instance. The poor quality of its crews, certainly of its surface ships. I think we have to distinguish there between those and its submarine force. We've long suspected that they're very heavily dependent on conscripts. There's a shortage of capable senior rates and NCOs. And of course, as the Moskva illustrated all too well, that the danger of relying on old, poorly designed major warships. So generally speaking, to sum up, it's still Russia, despite the losses.
I would generally agree with Mark on virtually everything he said there. Because I think the question of who's winning, well, it depends how you define winning at sea. And I think at the tactical level, obviously the Russian performance has been less than stellar. And obviously, you know, as Mark said, particularly with reference to the sinking of the flagship Moskva, the loss of the alligator landing ship at the port of Berdyansk, and obviously the recent actions on Snake Island. There's probably something we want to talk about at the technical level as well. I think generally speaking, the Russian armed forces, their ISTAR capability has been pretty poor, both at land as well as at sea. And I know we don't have a full account yet of the sinking of Moskva, but I believe there's some speculation that its radar coverage may not have been all it should have been or could have been. Consequently, so there's a tactical problem, there's technical problems, but I completely agree that at the level of strategy and theatre, then, sadly, the Russians are in the ascendancy. And I think, therefore, to answer the question, how well is the Russian Navy doing? If we take a step back and just think about what's its overall role in the grand plan, it seems to me that includes the striking of critical national infrastructure, industrial and military targets inland from the sea. And I guess the plan was really, if you go back to the 24th of February, the operations on land went on three broad axes, north, east, and south. And the Black Sea Fleet was providing essentially a maritime axis to complement that and to, undermine the Ukrainians' ability to wage war. I think it hasn't achieved that objective, but that's probably more as a consequence of the issues that the Russians have had on land. However, it's still been able to effectively, to some degree coerce the Ukrainian government and population via its bombardments. And as Mark was saying, it has affected an economic blockade in the south. And even though the presumed amphibious move against Odessa has probably miscarried, I think the geo-economic effects of that blockade in terms of food prices and also the consequential effect that might have on geopolitics in North Africa and the Middle East is a bit of a worry. It's something that we should be quite concerned about. You guys will recall that in the spark for the Arab Spring in 2011 was the high cost of food prices in Tunisia. So I fear that there could be a knock-on effect as a consequence of the Black Sea Fleet's general blockade. Again, I agree with Mark, it's going to be more of a distant blockade now as a consequence of the use of the very effective use of anti-shipping missiles by the Ukrainians. But nevertheless, I think I'm right in saying a couple of days ago the Russians said that they had reverted to using kilo-class submarines to launch caliber missiles in the Black Sea in order to make it a less risky operation for themselves. So I just think that this is going to be going on for quite some time. So to summarize, I would say that it's been a bit of a mixed bag for the Russian Navy, but their strategic performance has been better, I would suggest, than the Russian army. I suppose the other factor in play here is the Russian Air Force. The lack of air control that the Russian Air Force have been able to bring to the party has obviously had been a significant negative factor for both the Navy and the Army. And obviously the Black Sea Fleet doesn't have its own organic air capability. It can't call on carrier strike. That again speaks to the fact that a failure in one domain, the air domain, has had negative effects on the land and at sea and made it a riskier operation for the Russian Navy. I think I'm in violent agreement with Mark actually on his points.
So do you think the people who look at this just via the flashbang of social media and the propaganda, let's say, of Ukrainian side, which they're bound to do because it's something that can be used to try and give them an edge, misunderstanding the way the Russians work, the way the Black Sea has always been a tricky place to operate in, and in fact the Russians know what they're doing there. And also, before we touch on those two aspects, what about the NATO performance? I mean, it seems that NATO can't get ships in there, obviously, but would NATO even want to put ships in there? It just seems to be an absence of, unless it's submarines or in the air. There are no NATO navies operating at sea, are there? Or, unless I've missed it.
Well, there are NATO navies operating within the Mediterranean, the Baltic, and off the, or in the Norwegian Sea. The problem, of course, with the Black Sea is that it's physically controlled by Turkey, and it's that control is legally enforced through the Montreux Convention of 1936. And this places some very significant restrictions on what non-riparian or non-Black Sea navies can actually put into the Black Sea. They can't put submarines in, they can't put aircraft carriers, they can't put anything larger than 15,000 tons. There's actually an overall tonnage figure as well. And you're limited to 21 days. But at the moment, the Turks have warned off, I think that's the phrase, other navies from trying to make passage through the Bosphorus. I think a lot of us believe that they're probably pushing that their remit under the convention a little bit too far, because they're not actually under threat of military action themselves. But both sides are abiding by that. As you said earlier, the Black Sea has always been very difficult for a combination of those physical constraints and that convention. And therefore, NATO is entirely reliant on the maritime capabilities of the full NATO members within the Black Sea. So that's Romania and Bulgaria, and their navies are not very powerful. And of course, Turkey. And with Turkey, then you're reliant on the viewpoint of President Erdogan, who clearly has his distinct personal agenda.
Yeah, just on your point about the information war. I mean, obviously that's a very legitimate dimension in this conflict. And obviously, you know, Zelensky, Western governments, NATO have been well in the ascendancy in terms of the information war. But I guess for sober analysis of what's actually going on at the military level, then, you know, I guess it's easy to get carried away with our old synth feeds on Twitter. And because we're not neutral in this conflict. Our government's not neutral in this conflict. We're an active player in the conflict, but we're also analysts. So we need to take a step back from some of that, OSINT data. And try and analyze. And it's not a surprise to me that Mark and I, with our backgrounds, immediately we start looking at it from the kind of the higher levels of strategy as well as the lower levels. But having said that, information war is a legitimate dimension. And so I'm not surprised it's being used in that way on social media and in mainstream media. As for NATO, I think the question there is what is NATO going to do? If Erdogan would let NATO deploy more naval power in the Black Sea, what would its function be? Which raises the thornier question of to what extent are we prepared to go down into something more confrontational and more direct? Now, I actually listened to a webinar the other day put out by the think tank Res Publica, and General Breedlove was on there, and I don't know if you saw it, Mark.
No, I didn't, but I know the general's writings well and his viewpoint. Yeah,
and they were basically, he was basically saying, yeah, we need to get involved heavily in the Black Sea. And, you know, and on land, we need to basically occupy Western Ukraine. You know, everything west of the Dnieper should have NATO forces involved. And the Black Sea should become a NATO lake, in effect. Which, you know, I don't know, you listen to that and it kind of course that's desirable, you know, absolutely, that would be fantastic. But we have to be, you know, I hate to use the word realistic a little bit, I think, because have we really thought it through? Because we'll get onto this as we go on, but it would be naive to assume, in my opinion, that if that happens, the conflict is contained in the Black Sea. If you were the Russians, there would be no upside in just accepting that.
Exactly. I honestly don't think that there's any political appetite for going down that road. I think we've gone as far as we are prepared to go. And let's face it, that's a long way, particularly with the request that President Biden made of Congress for $33 billion of aid, and most of that would be in military aid. So it's clear that the Americans want to, as the Secretary of Defense, Austin, said, weaken Russia, so they can't do this again. But unfortunately for the Ukrainians, they're expected to do the fighting. The West will provide them with the weapons, they'll provide them with the intelligence, they'll provide them with the training. But what we're trying to avoid is that wider conflict that you alluded to. And I'm sure that if we were to try and barge into the Black Sea, that's what we would get. I don't for a moment at the moment anyway, believe that Erdogan would allow us to, because, as I said, he's got his own agenda.
Does the way the war is unfolding at sea mean that as and when it settles down, which may take months, years, whatever it is, that navies like Bulgaria's, Romania's in NATO might as well give up surface warships and focus on anti-shipping missiles or something like that, and submarines, rather than have X Royal Navy Type 22 frigates and X Belgian frigates, because clearly those vessels would, if they deployed to sea, even at the moment, that would create a flashpoint and they would be very easily sunk. So people focus on what Germany said it's going to do and what we may do and what the Americans may do to modernize and tweak things. But those navies, the Black Sea NATO navies, are surely going to require a shake-up and rethink if they're going to be effective at all. Would you think that's going to be the case?
Well, it's been the case for many years. I can remember having a conversation with a former Romanian defence attaché many years ago. And the Romanians were very honest. They knew that they had to expand their navy. They knew why. But it's a question, of course, of resources. I happen to think that there is a role, or would be a role, for decent surface ships in the Romanian Bulgarian navies, particularly, for example, in terms of convoy escort. But of course, they have to be capable of defending themselves, and at the moment, that is not the case. And as you said, if they were to be used in that role, legitimately, legally, it would inevitably cause a flashpoint, and that's something that NATO doesn't want to get near at the present.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I suppose the only other thing to say is, when we look at how the Russians have responded to the threat from the littoral, they seem to be going under the sea. I guess this speaks to that broader air-to-air debate, which has been going on for many years, and the challenges that, Western navies would face vis-a-vis China in particular, but also Russia. And I suppose what we've seen so far underlines the utility of submarines in terms of survivability, but also really underlines the ever necessary requirement for really excellent air defense capabilities on surface ships, which obviously we're going to talk about the Falklands in a bit. And there is a definite parallel, I think, there between what's going on now. So are there lessons? So there's lessons for the Romania and Bulgaria to absorb from the Russian experience, perhaps. Though I suppose, Ian, you could argue it the other way. You could look at the asymmetrical way in which the Ukrainians have brought power from the land to affect the sea battle. Open question.
Yeah, but what the Ukrainians have done is really something very similar to traditional Russian maritime strategy, which is based fundamentally on sea denial. And the problem with a land power that's able to deny the sea to a maritime power is that it is just that. They can't use it to facilitate their own operations. So Ukraine can, hold the Russians off, but they can't use the sea to trade. They can't use the sea to bring in military logistics. You mentioned the improved kilos, the Project 636.3s. I do wonder, though, if that is not at least in part intended as a signal to the West as to Russia's undersea land attack cruise missile capability, which they've been very keen to talk up for some time. If they wanted to keep their caliber surface launchers, whether we're talking about the Grigorievich frigates or the Buyan-Ms, the corvettes, given the range of the caliber, which is around about 2,000 kilometres, they could easily outrange the Neptunes. I think one of the things that we've long been concerned about are those kilos, or indeed the ability of submarines to launch effective land attack cruise missiles. And I can remember giving a briefed on MARCOM some years ago, and I pointed out that, you know, even operating in the deep waters of the Black Sea, those kilos could theoretically bring in range most of Eastern Europe and on the Mediterranean. And if we look at it from a UK perspective, a submarine launch caliber would enable a Russian submarine to hit any part of the UK launching from beyond the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap. So I wonder if there's a little bit of strategic signalling going on. It's a little bit like, you know, the threats that we've had from Putin about this or that super weapon or the latest ICBM. Of course, you're only going to be aware of that if you know the sort of background. But of course, I suspect that his target audience is other capitals of Europe, not ordinary folk.
But do the capitals of Europe, do the politicians who are caught up in all sorts of other things, whether it's the cost of living crisis or debates about cake and beer and et cetera and curries, do they notice such things? Are they too boring? You know, kilo class submarines, you know, the minute you say a kilo class submarine to them, they're just sort of, their eyes might glaze over. You know, I mean, I understand it. And yeah, you understand,
well, exactly.
It, you know,
depends how good their briefings are, I suppose.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been pretty clear for a long time, hasn't it, that the Russians have been very canny by building six for the Black Sea, and I believe six for the Northern Fleet as well. And we could see what was coming. So this is, as you say, this is a demonstration of that. But I wonder if they notice. But hopefully the briefers are telling them. Yeah.
Just really briefly, just on your general point about public perception of defence and, you know, does it have any cut through during cost of living and debates about curry and beer and that kind of thing? It's a really obvious point to make. On the one hand, the answer is no. But on the other hand is, well, ask the Ukrainians what's the most vital public service they have at the moment. And clearly it's defence, because it's existential. I'm probably pushing out an open door with this comment with you guys, but I worry greatly that the debate in this country isn't really happening enough, isn't happening sufficiently. And, you know, you'll have seen Mark Carlton Smith's, I'm segueing in the army, Mark Carlton Smith's comments 2 days ago, former chief of the general staff, just recently retired. And he said he didn't agree with the cuts that were being made to the army, even though he'd obviously championed them in public whilst he was CGS. And, you know, I don't know, it's a bit of a bugbear of mine, and I know it's a complex area. But if we're ever going to have a proper adult debate about the nature, the size, the composition of the armed forces, if not now, when?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, when you saw the report a few days ago in the Times, in which it was claimed, and I suspect correctly, that the Prime Minister had requested that the Defence Secretary withdraw his letter to the Chancellor of the Exchequer asking for more funds because it wasn't appropriate. I think we can all congratulate the Prime Minister on actually having the courage of Ben Wallace's convictions last year, because it was he who really pushed for the export of key weapons, notably the NLAWs, to the Ukraine, against considerable opposition within both the MOD and the Foreign Office. But it's all fine and dandy to defend the Ukrainians. What about the United Kingdom? And I think there is a significant pushback. You know, we've now been given that information about Ben Wallace. We saw Liz Truss's very important speech, I have to say, the other week at the Mansion House, in which she quite explicitly linked the failure to fund defence with an inability to deter Vladimir Putin's aggression, and argued for a significant increase in defence, saying that 2% should be a floor, not a ceiling.
No, definitely.
And I couldn't agree more.
But in saying that, she was just stating the obvious, really, that has been there for many years, because people always bang on about the we're reaching the 2%. And yes. In the magazine, we always point out that's not the target. That's the minimum. So,
and as we all know, in some years we only reach that 2% by some rather interesting accounting techniques.
So before we move on from Ukraine, in terms of lessons that you could draw from what has happened so far at sea in general, what's the short-term and long-term implication of it all for naval warfare and strategy?
Quite a few, actually. the short term, although in truth it's not short term, it's the lessons have been there certainly since the 60s and certainly since 1967. And that's the danger posed by anti-ship missiles, particularly when used in the literal. And if we define the literal as the area of the sea which can be influenced from the land, then land-based anti-ship missiles, as they become ever more sophisticated and ever longer range, increases the threats very, very significantly. And, of course, to that you can now add UAVs. And I think the performance of those UAVs, particularly against those fast-moving Raptors off Snake Island, was really quite something to see. Now, it should be remembered that Ukraine has very few of these missiles. China can deploy thousands, and that should be the real planning threat. What this actually points to is a longer term or a bigger issue, and it's something my students will you know, say, "Oh, here he goes." Something I've been banging on for years, and that is sea control, or maritime battle space dominance, is what I actually prefer to call it, is an absolutely essential enabler of other maritime operations. Without that, you can't do anything else. So, if we've got any pretensions towards global power and influence, if we're going to back up the AUKUS agreement with some hard power, we've got to start investing in these full spectrum maritime capabilities. Because if we don't, we'll be sending our young men and women into a conflict as ill-equipped as their predecessors were 40 years ago.
Yeah, I absolutely concur with that. I think, you know, again, I raised an eyebrow reading the defense equipment plan, and the way a lot of kind of key technologies that feed into what Marcus just said have been pushed to the right. They're being delayed, and that just seems to be really, really unfortunate. I think it's very unfortunate that the ISSGW program was cancelled. It doesn't look particularly timely in the light of what's just happened in the Black Sea. And
sorry to interrupt, but that's the intermediate surface to...
Surface guided weapon.
Sorry.
Yeah. So the Harpoon replacement. Now, the argument there is that I think, I feel a lot of sympathy for Chief of the Defence Staff, First Sea Lord, certain ministers. They understand. They keep using, we need increased lethality. And that's absolutely correct, because it enhances your deterrence. And we don't want to go to war with Russia. We want to deter an escalation. But we have to have credibility in order to do that. And put in a very simplistic way, it's very, very, it takes a long time and a lot of money to build more platforms. But I can't wrap my head around why we're not expending some resources to get our existing platforms more battle ready and increasing stocks as well. Because I think that's what we could do without breaking the bank. And actually, just to touch on the significance of this with the Falklands, 1981 command paper, which is an infamous document in many respects, the one good element I thought that not actually touched upon at the time was actually the need for increased lethality and increased weapon stocks. So, I think that he wrote that in 81 in a position, in the last period of great power conflict, and we're in a new period of great power conflict. So our forces need to be configured to recognise that external reality.
That's true. I mean, I often feel that what happened with the end of the Cold War was that things stopped and we went off in a, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, went off in a different direction. And then while we were off doing... fighting, wars like Operation Granby, kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and then getting involved in Afghanistan and the Balkans, and doing the Second Iraq War and in the Adriatic, the Royal Navy and other navies in Europe allowed things to kind of stand still, and all the potential foes, or the main potential foes, have increased their lethality tenfold, 100-fold, and now that it's been revealed to us, all the things that we've seen in Ukraine war, which requires you to have stocks of missiles, to have the capability, to have land-based missile systems, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't seem to be a lot going on. It doesn't seem to be a shock to the system. So And this is a way of segueing to the Falklands. As a 18-year-old schoolboy in Portsmouth, I well remember the hope and the arrogance and the jingoistic feeling that was abroad, certainly in Portsmouth, that the troops and the ships would go down there to the South Atlantic, and it would be a short war where there'd be hardly any fighting. And if there was, then we would soon defeat the Argentinians with little cost or any cost to ourselves. And that would be that. But of course, that Exocet missile that came in after the sinking of the Belgrano, which we probably thought, well, that'll be it. The Argentinians have had a bloody nose and they'll cave in now. But the Exocet came in and hit the Sheffield. And that was a profound shock, particularly in Portsmouth. You know, I remember feeling very sad and upset and very far from jingoistic about the war then, you know, as a teenager, patriotic teenager. And so does the UK have to face another one of those shocks? Can we take the message, you know, from the Ukraine? And what do you think? I mean, Gary, maybe you could start this one off. The lessons of the Falklands that are relevant are still there. What are they?
Well, I think that we've already touched on air defence. And, you know, you're talking about the loss of Sheffield, and we've talked about the loss for the Russians of Moskva. So I think that, you know, the lessons that were learned, and there was a command paper came out in 1982 to try and make good sense of the lessons that had been learned. Then are obviously kind of relevant now as well, because of what we've seen in the Black Sea. And if you go back to 1982, you know, and it touches on, you know, aspects of just the complexity of trying to pull off that operation 8,000 miles away from home in a very hostile environment. And you see, you know, bits of technology not working as was anticipated because of things like the fog of war and friction and so on. And what that means is that, so for example, you know, the Sea Dart missile systems weren't functioning properly because some of the electronic switches are becoming crusted with sea salt. The Sea Wolf missile system could only tackle targets coming at it head on. And it was only after the war that these deficiencies were put right. And people realized, well, actually, if you're going to operate in that environment and not lose people, and not lose ships, then you need a certain level of technical wherewithal. And so I think at that level of technology, those lessons that were learned in 82 are still relevant in 2022. I guess the problem is, you know, there is obviously, because of things like defense inflation, these things always come with a premium, and each new generation of weapon system is more expensive than the last one. And the countermeasures are better and more sophisticated and so on and so forth. But there comes a point in the geopolitical picture where actually you have to find the money. And, you know, I'm conscious as I say that there'll be lots of commentators listening to this saying, where's the money coming from? But to be honest, as a defense analyst, that's almost like a second order question. A defense analyst really is looking at the threats. And looking at the scale of the threats and the nature of the threats. So I think the Falklands actually, I mean, just as an academic as well, I have to say I've always loved it as a case study. Because when you teach strategic theory, when you talk about these great thinkers of the past, like Clausewitz and Corbett and people like that, then it's quite dry. But when you bring a case study to bear, it really brings it to life. And the Falklands, I think, is a magnificent case study in that regard. Because the British had to overcome so many impediments, the distance, the tyranny of the distance, the logistical challenge, the technical problems. And actually, the one thing that always sticks with me, the reason why I think the British prevailed in 1982 was actually, and it sounds a bit cliche, but it was actually the people. That conflict demodernized quite rapidly because of the things I've just described. And yet the people, in terms of the commanders and the individual sailors and soldiers, were adaptable enough to actually deal with the challenges better than the opposition numbers, which is not to denigrate the Argentinians at all. And so the Falklands, so I think there are some kind of timeless lessons within the Falklands. When we look at the Falklands campaign, just about the dimensions of strategy And so, but really, in a way, the key lesson really was in 1982, they looked at some of the ships that had been down there and said, actually, we need to make them better. And we need to make them less like, I'm going to use a slightly provocative phrase here, but less like a HMS 80% ship and more like a HMS 100% ship. And I think that's where we're back to that again now. Sorry, that was a bit long-winded. But.
I think that the ships in 82 were actually less than 80%. Something that always shocks my junior warfare officers is that not one warship that we sent down to the South Atlantic in 1982 was actually capable of defending itself against the full range of Argentine air threats. This was at a time when we were supposed to be preparing to fight the Soviets. Type 22s came closest, but as you said, they were not perfect and could only engage short-range targets in any case. But none of the others could. Most of the escorts were reliant on short-range SeaCat missile, which basically didn't work, and the older county-class destroyers on the Sea Slug, which, as its rather iffy name suggests, definitely didn't work. What we had done during the 1950s is sacrifice the large number of anti-aircraft artillery pieces that would have festooned Aryan warships at the end of the Second World War in favour of this bright, shiny new technology, which, yeah, could be made to work when you needed to demonstrate it to those who are paying the checks in ideal conditions. But war seldom happens in ideal conditions. That, to me, is appalling, and I really don't want that to happen again. If I'm being honest, we're actually very good today at defending our ships. We've learned a lot of lessons, and we keep learning those lessons from the Falklands with regard to how you should command a ship in war, how you should design a ship, damage control procedures and so on. And the approach that we have adopted, which is very much a layered approach with regard to sensors and defensive weapon systems, both kinetic and electronic, I think would work. My concern, as was raised before, is that we simply do not have the ability to engage anybody else's ships, except with a 4.5-inch gun and harsh language. And in truth, the Falklands was far closer run thing than most people understand. And in some ways, and this is certainly not to denigrate the courage of those who went down there, in some ways we won because we made fewer mistakes than the Argentinians. And very often this is how wars are decided. But you look at all sorts of aspects of the operation. If you look at the carrier side, the air group side, if you look at the amphibious side, this was all done really much on a wing and a prayer. And you can't but help thinking that if we'd been operating against a rather more astute opponent, then we wouldn't have been so fortunate. And you can't always bank on the other side being even more dim-witted than you are. In many respects, we were lucky. And a few different tactical decisions, particularly on the air side, from the Argentinians may have changed it.
Right. And I suppose... particularly now, today, there isn't time. There is no time to upgrade warships. Of course, you know, there's no time. It's a bit like the lifeboat party. You know, when the war, if there's going to be a major war with Russia, when it happens, you've got to go with what you're wearing. You know,
yes,
showing
that
lifeboat. You know,
yeah, absolutely. You take what you've got.
And so, if you have a Type 45 destroyer or any other warship that is fitted for but not with. You know, there's going to be no time. The war will be starting, decided, over and done with within what, days or a couple of weeks or whatever, an hour or two. So it does seem rather insane not to, as Gary said, put all the weaponry into these vessels.
Yeah. I mean, so for example, there are the UK stocks of Tomahawks, TLAMs, is about 100. So how long will that last, you know?
Well, because we can only fire them from a very small number of submarines, and they can't carry at least the last T boat is probably it. The A boats can carry rather more. But rather longer than you might think. You know, if you were firing at them out of an Arleigh Burke, well, it wouldn't be enough for two ships for a day.
Exactly. So I go back to the point I made about, you know, if people are looking for inspiration from history, you know, you can look at the Knot Review and actually, okay, he clearly was disproven by history because obviously he decided to, he was going to sell Invincible to Australia, for example. But there is still that, you know, good thinking in that document actually around stocks and increasing the lethality of our ships, which seems incredibly timely for today. For the reasons we're talking about.
But should it be a surprise? You know, if you've got a warship, surely it should be both able to defend itself and to inflict harm on the Queen's enemies. Well, at the moment, we can just about defend ourselves, depending on how many missiles get lobbed our way. But we can't inflict much harm. What Gary said about after the Cold War, right? No, actually, I think it was here. So after the Cold War, we stood still. No, we didn't actually. We actually went back because we thought that, and we weren't alone in this. The Americans shared this view that the maritime environment in the future would be ever more benign. And therefore we could safely forget that, if you like, the sea control standards. So, carrier air combat at range. Anti-ship missiles, ASW. And of course, surprise, surprise, we've found out that the maritime environment is far from benign. In fact, it's probably more complex and dangerous than it's ever been. And we're now facing, particularly in the case of China, a state and a navy that has identified those gaps in Western navies, particularly on the sea control side. And they have exploited those gaps ruthlessly. And we are now up against a serious numbers game, whether we're talking about platforms or whether we're talking about missiles. And this, I must admit, as you can probably tell, worries me a great deal.
Yeah. And so, actually, it gives me an idea for how we can segue into the next bit, because I think it's possibly about mentality. And how the Navy thinks about itself, how politicians think about the Navy, and the general public, most of them don't even think about the Navy. But it's the whole thing whereby they believe the spin and they believe the business corporate stuff. And a classic example of that has been over the years, recent years, has been this thing about we're building a bigger Navy. And yeah, some of the ships are bigger. They've got more tonnage, but the Navy's not bigger. And if it wasn't so small, you wouldn't have to make it bigger. And I think the aircraft carriers, much though I love them and I think they're a fantastic investment, are an illustration of how certain people look at the big ships and say, look, there's a big ship. We've built it. Isn't it impressive? And then the Russians look at it and we don't really take them seriously, but the Russians say that's just a convenient large target, and they're quite right. So when you see Prince of Wales or Queen Elizabeth deploying at the time and the Russians are being very menacing at sea, as we've seen in the past few months, without the full war-fighting complement of jets or maybe even helicopters that could fire anti-shipping missiles, whatever. When you see them going to the high north on cold weather trials, which are, of course, important for Prince of Wales, but with a flight deck clear of everything except a single Merlin, you do think, and Mark, you've written about this in the next edition of the magazine, you do think, where's the mentality about fighting, about, frankly, destroying the enemy? Because the enemy, the future enemies, the Russians we know already, maybe the Chinese one day, are thinking very much about just wiping us out and killing us. So an essential element of any Navy as an armed fighting force has to be that ability to inflict pain and damage, as you said, you gentlemen have said, on the opposition and destroy them. You know, that's what it's about. It's not, I think somebody once said, it's not aggressive camping, you know, for scouts. It's warfare.
It is.
So Mark, you know, to segue into the bit about the carriers, I'm sure that's what you've been thinking when you see such big ships without their jets.
I do, but it's across the piece. And there is no point in having these ships unless they have their proper complement of sensors and weapons. And when it comes to the carrier, in the short term, that there was an optics problem here. And I'm not the only one to have noticed this. Yeah, we had the great success of CDSG-21 last year, and it was very, very successful.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Although one has to remember that we were heavily reliant on the United States Marine Corps to make it a success. But to send Prince of Wales north for Cold Response 22, acting solely as the NATO command ship, just looked bizarre. It looked bizarre from a number of points of view. A, originally, that exercise was supposed to have Harry S. Truman providing carrier air support. And very sensibly, she was retained in the Mediterranean, acting along with Cavour and Charles de Gaulle in order to deter the Russians down there. But you would have then expected, given that we have two operational carriers, to have been able to backfill, and we couldn't. Now, the answer to that is, oh, well, we're slowly regenerating after CSG-21. Well, fine, but Charles de Gaulle deployed last year for many months as well. She was able to do it, and she was tasked away from a pre-existing French exercise. So it just didn't look good in terms of short-term optics. But what I'm really concerned about is what it says about how those carriers are viewed. And far too many people view those carriers as convenient bits of floating UK real estate from which to operate half a dozen or a dozen RAF jets, Naval Air Service jets, if you like, fleet air arm jets, when it is convenient to do so. This fundamentally, it's a fundamental misunderstanding about what carriers and their carrier aviation elements are. The carrier's main weapon system is its aircraft. And that capability is absolutely core, essential to how a properly constituted strike group, a task group, should be run. And if we do not have the ability to generate sufficient numbers of aircraft to do the full range of tasks, and that isn't just carrier strike, targets in particular states, that is long distance combat air patrols, interception of enemy aircraft, which would probably be coming at you with anti-ship missiles. It's surface search. It's suppression and destruction of enemy air defences over the territory wished to attack. It's anti-ship strike. It's the full gamut. And here we really need to stop thinking that we can, reinvent this better, because the United States Navy has worked this out since the 1920s. Those carrier wings that are embarked stay with the carrier for long periods of the time. They train up together. They go on operations together. The carrier aircraft are integral to the ship and to the task group. We need to get away from, as I said, the I think I've used the phrase, sort of viewing the aircraft as itinerant occasional visitors. And that, I think, is what too many view them as. Now, there is a challenge here, and of course it's a resources challenge. And it's one of the consequences of acquiring these on a joint ticket. There is no doubt that the RAF requires the same sort of capable deep strike aircraft. And indeed, they were acquired for that role. But the problem is that when you have rather few of them, you can't do both roles at the same time. And therefore, clearly, over the last few months, at the time of Cold Response 22, the RAF required those aircraft to be doing other things. And it points to the challenges that we face if we are to get the best value out of those multi-billion pound ships. And at the moment, I fear that we're not.
Yeah, I mean, 100% agree with that. I think that the alarming thing is when you look at the defence equipment plan, is to bring the capability to maturity in order to give the UK government a really flexible instrument.
Yes.
You need to expedite Spear 3, FCASW, Meteor. All these things need to be integrated now. Okay, FCSW is a long-term project. I get that, but the Spear Cap 3 and Meteor, why are they not being expedited? And when you look at the defense equipment plan, there'll be a line item there, and it will save a few million quid by pushing it to the right. But actually, but then what about the actual predicament we potentially find ourselves in? Actually, that's going to come back to the left. And whatever clever accounting device, be it an urgent operational requirement or just borrowing the money, and financing a rearmament program through government gilts, which you could easily do over, decades, which we did in the past. I think the problem with carriers, though, and Mark will be better informed than I am on this, but I just think in this country in particular, we have a particular problem dealing with the fact that we have aircraft carriers. And for all the chatter about, jointery and, being purple on this particular topic, the French don't seem to have this problem. The French don't seem to sort of agonize over whether or not we should have a carrier capability. The Italians don't seem to have this problem. Those countries just go and do it. And I can't help but think, we're potentially getting into pretty deep water here about the British way in warfare and where we see the geostrategic center of gravity being. But I just get, look at France. France sees itself as a Pacific power. France is not embarrassed about the idea of projecting its power on the other side of the world. You mentioned global Britain and the UK, and half the country buries its head in its hands and says, what we're doing talking about these delusions of grandeur. It's actually got nothing to do with that. It's got nothing to do with post-imperial ambitions or putting the empire back together or any of that nonsense.
No.
It's about the fact that countries that sit on the United Nations Security Council have global interests. And that takes you inevitably back to the Navy, which is not to say the Army and the Air Force don't have a role to play. Of course they do. But once you go east of Suez, obviously it's going to be more of a dark blue type enterprise. And yet we agonize over it. We agonize. And it's been going on for decades, obviously. But now I really do think now is the time to have a grown up debate about these things and stop being so immature. Actually, it really strikes me that some of the debates in the official world are really immature.
Yes, but there's dear old inter-service politics running underneath this.
Yeah.
And it's caused us so many problems, really, since 1918. And again, as I say in the article, I have no problem with the RAF. The RAF fulfills many very important roles and has done so historically. The problem I have is, and this, I should emphasize, is very much a personal view, the problem I have is that its role in the provision of maritime air has not entirely been consistently constructive, I think is the phrase that I use. And when there are choices to be made, whether or not funding or resources should be allocated to a maritime task or whether they should be allocated to a core RAF task, there's no prize for guessing which way they're going to be spent. And that's what worries me, particularly, and as you made reference to global Britain, whether people like it or not, government foreign policy, and this has been developing now over several governments, has been to engage much more broadly with the wider world, particularly the Indo-Pacific. And as you quite rightly said, that inevitably means maritime stroke naval power. We've got some of the resources to do that. But if the government is serious about that ambition, then it has to get serious about providing the Navy with the sort of task group capability that enables us to operate there, not just to send diplomatic messages as we were doing last year, but to operate there in terms of hard power and to do so as safely and as successfully as possible. And the way that we can, you quite rightly made reference to the defense equipment program, and it's just this lackadaisical approach to procurement that frustrates me. But the way that is set out does not fill me with too much confidence that we will actually be able to give the government the sort of tools that it clearly wants.
Well, when you talk about inter-service rivalry, I'm reminded about a friend of mine who's an SSN captain who was standing beside an army officer at Greenwich. This is back in the days of yore, when it was a staff college. And he was looking out over the river, and I think a Type 21 frigate sailed by on its way up to, or some other frigate sailed by on its way up to berth by HMS Belfast. And the army officer basically suggested to him that a frigate was just like an artillery piece, a floating artillery battery. And he saw it purely in terms of there's a gun on it. And then when you think about the RAF, they look at Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales and think, ah, it's an airfield. We use it occasionally. And I mean, is that a simple way of putting it, do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. As I say, it's a convenient bit of British territory, which they can operate from when they see fit. Not all of them do. And this is it. And I think we need to distinguish, you know, from what I've heard of last year's deployment, you know, from an inter-service point of view, it was very, very successful. But the same could be said if you go back 20 years ago. You know, the same was said of, you know, the relationship between RAF and RN, you know, during the time of the GR7s and GR9s. Didn't stop that capability being binned when it suited some to bin it. What they don't understand is, if you like, is the nuances of maritime warfare. And I sometimes say to this to people, you know, it looks fairly simple, and in broad terms, naval warfare, I suppose, is. But there are lots of nuances which need to be explained to people. And I'm absolutely certain that they're not aware. And for all that we have, you know, a joint staff college, from what I have heard, they could do with being rather more maritime up there than currently is the case.
Goes back to the point about budgets inevitably, and obviously inter-service rivalry will flare up when budgets are tight. But it goes back to the point that actually it's the old debate about a threat-based strategy versus a capability-based strategy, which are really two sides of the same coin, because there's always a logical limit to how much you can spend, even in World War II. But really, you know, a threat-based approach is the way to go. And unfortunately, we you know, the world has changed significantly since the post-Cold War world and the end of history, as Francis Fukuyama's book put it. But I actually think, you know, I don't know, it's no delicate way to put this, really. I don't think there is clearly a problem with the services in the sense of they'll fight for a general will say the value of a tank, an admiral, a ship, an air marshal, a fast jet. It's really the level above that where somebody somewhere has to say, hang on, guys, you know, strategy, deterrence, these things require a broader look, but they also require a broader budget. And there's absolutely no, and then, you know, people will invoke poor defence procurement programmes correctly. So Ajax is, well, I guess, the latest villain of the piece. But the reality is that we have to do something. We can't just keep on trucking along like this because we're in a brand new world. So I share the frustration in terms of what we're talking about.
Well, when you think that last year Chinese Navy commissioned 22 warships, including, let me get the figures right now, three Type 55 cruisers, so 13,500 tons, six Type 52 DL destroyers, so that's each of those is about 8,500 tons. It's somewhere in the region of an additional 800, just under 800 VLS tubes, just amongst those. I despair, you know, and okay, it's perfectly legitimate for any state to have capable armed forces. But in the case of China, it's the strategic context. And here we have, you know, an increasingly assertive, aggressive, authoritarian state with clear ambitions, not just a regional dominance, but, you know, with a view to reordering the global international system. And, you know, it's appalling how slowly that particular penny is dropping, and it still seems to be in flight. And I must admit, I do get very frustrated with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's big picture stuff, and maybe some people that have their hands on the levers of power just haven't got the ability to grasp them. And so to wrap up this fascinating discussion. How much time do you think we've got? Is there any time? You know, because I look at the war in Ukraine and I think, well, with a bit of luck, we'll come through this without having a nuclear holocaust, you know, Armageddon, and then we can have a bit of a reset, see what's left of Ukraine, hopefully retain access to the sea, let it settle down, maybe, and then maybe Europe, the world, NATO in particular, obviously, and the UK especially, can then think hard and long and get a move on and then reconfigure and do all those things we've talked about to enable us to, as you say, defend ourselves and also deter the enemy. And if they take action, actually destroy them. So how long do each of you think we've got? I mean, is this going to be a new Cold War where we've got time to make good all the gaps and all the problems? Or is it game on right now?
Personally, I think it's game on right now. I think the problem is that Vladimir Putin has maximalist aims in the East. Some of our statements could be described as maximalist and increasingly so. The risk is actually, obviously, we all want Ukraine to be a safe and sovereign state. But if the Russian regime is really on the back foot, the risk is that then the war escalates into other areas, particularly the North Atlantic, the Norwegian Sea, the Arctic, the Baltic, and, you know, and then we have no time, realistically. So I think, I mean, I believe in the precautionary principle, which is basically that we should assume the worst and hope for the best, which is why I really focus on that defense equipment plan. And the integrated review, actually, I thought was a pretty good document. And actually, I don't think anything that's happened has undermined its basic thoughts and premises. But under the radar, we then get this pushing to the right of all these kind of project programs, all of which actually, as Mark said earlier, we don't currently have that kit, so we need it now. So that sounds quite bleak, but bear in mind, you know, people have to bear in mind that what we're talking about here is deterrence. We're not talking it. We're trying to forestall the worst event. We are, through good deterrence, trying to limit the geographical blowback of this situation. But it's not going to happen by magic. So, you know, our lords and masters need to crack on, in my opinion.
I think that there are longer term dangers. You know, we would all like Vladimir Putin to disappear one way or the other from the scene. And, you know, if you believe some reports as to his health, he might well do that. But whenever he goes, I think there are too many people that assume that he will be replaced by some, you know, sort of fluffy Western orientated democratic government. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that at all. Putin has a significant amount of support within government circles, within the military, and perhaps more importantly, within the population as a whole. The Russians that Western journalists tend to talk to are those middle-class affluent types that live in St. Petersburg or Moscow. The vast majority of Russians have a low standard of living. They live in sprawling working-class suburbs or in the vast rural hinterland. So I'm afraid that whichever way this goes, we're in for the long term, because surely the successors of Putin, having suffered a rather embarrassing reverse, or so it appears, and clearly aware of the hostility of the rest of the, certainly the West or the global system, the democratic system, perhaps I should say, could well be looking for some future recompense. And so I think the possibility of wider conflict within Europe, sadly, is going to remain a long-term one. But of course, as I keep making the point, we've not just got to worry about Russia, we have got to worry about China as well. And certainly according to some analysts, and I think I would share this, irrespective of what lessons, if any, Xi is taking from the current conflict, we believe that he has got his own agenda and his own timetable with regard in particular to Taiwan. And we are entering a period of significant danger. So taken together, this is as Gary said, it's here and now. It's we can't hope that this is going to, just sort of disappear down the road. And therefore, I think a sense of urgency, to put it mildly, is required. And the lack of any urgency is frankly astonishing, given the strategic environment, the strategic challenges that we clearly face.
Yeah, one last point I would make is that, just to pick up on Mark's points, if you look at it in geopolitical terms, this is kind of Halford Mackinder's prophecy coming, being made real, in the sense of a Sino-Russian axis would be, which is kind of feels like it already is a de facto alliance, is the worst of all worlds. It really is. And the other area that we haven't mentioned is the Gulf. Now, let's think forward to the autumn. Let's think forward to what the gas supply is going to be looking like in the autumn. Let's think about inflation. Let's think about the price of electricity. Anything negative happening in the Gulf is going to make it's going to be like, it already is like 1973. It's going to be like 1973 in terms of the oil shock with brass knobs on. And so I completely concur with what everyone's saying. It's that, come on, guy. This is now. Let's do something about it. Let's be proactive rather than waiting.
Right. Well, I think that's brilliant. I know it's not uplifting for some people, but I think if you know what the problem is, then you can do something about it. And as I was listening to you there, I thought that just an attempt at a weak joke here to pay off. Whatever happens in the next few years or weeks or even months, we can be assured it won't be a piece of cake. I know. I'm sorry. I apologise for that.
Personally, I think that's a resigning matter myself.
Oh, really? Are we not going to go down that road? So we better sign off. So anyway, chaps, thanks very much for your very, very wise words.
No, thank you for inviting me. No, thank you, Ian.
Yeah, thanks, Ian.
In the June edition on the Ukraine war, we have a special article on the death of the Moskva, which was the worst loss for the Russian Navy since the Kursk in 2000, and also Cold War vessels in the Russian order of battle, which we refer to as the Cold War Achilles heel at sea of the Russian Navy. And also on the menu is another one of our Falklands War 40 perspectives, and this time looking at whether or not the Falklands War itself has slipped from the public's consciousness. And we also look at the US Navy's future warship building plans, Canadian Navy submarines, Russia's new icebreakers, and also UK strategy up there in the high north of the Arctic too. If you'd like to obtain the magazine itself, please visit your local newsagent and pick one up from the shelf. Or, if you like, ask them if they can order it in. Alternatively, visit the Warships IFR website, warshipsifr.com, and you can obtain it that way. You can subscribe to get a hard copy each month direct to you wherever you are in the world, or get a digital edition. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at warshipsifr, and also Twitter at warshipsifr. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.